he was called to the deliverance of the Caliph Qayyim, and obeyed the holy summons, which gave a new kingdom to his arms. In the palace of Baghdad, the commander of the faithful still slumbered, a venerable phantom. His servant or master, the prince of the Bawidis, could no longer protect him from the insolence of meaner tyrants. Then the Euphrates and Tigris were oppressed by the revolt of the Turkish and Arabian emirs. The presence of a conqueror was implored as a blessing, and the transient mischiefs of fire and sword were excused as the sharp but salutary remedies which alone could restore the health of the Republic. At the head of an irresistible force, the Sultan of Persia marched from Hamadan. The proud were crushed, the prostrate were spared. The prince of the Bawidis disappeared. The heads of the most obstinate rebels were laid at the feet of Toghrul, and he inflicted a lesson of obedience on the people of Mosul and Baghdad. After the chastisement of the guilty and the restoration of peace, the royal shepherd accepted the reward of his labors, and a solemn comedy represented the triumph of religious prejudice over barbarian power. The Turkish sultan embarked on the Tigris, landed at the gate of Raqqa, and made his public entry on horseback. At the palace gate he respectfully dismounted, and walked on foot, preceded by his emirs without arms. The caliph was seated behind his black veil. The black garment of the Abbasides was cast over his shoulders, and he held in his hand the staff of the Apostle of God. The conqueror of the East kissed the ground, stood some time in a modest posture, and was led towards the throne by the vizier and interpreter. After Toghrul had seated himself on another throne, his commission was publicly read, which declared him the temporal lieutenant of the vicar of the prophet. He was successively invested with 7 robes of honor and presented with 7 slaves, the natives of the 7 climates of the Arabian Empire. His mystic veil was perfumed with musk. 2 crowns were placed on his head. 2 scimitars were girded to his side, as the symbols of a double reign over the east and west. After this inauguration, the sultan was prevented from prostrating himself a second time, but he twice kissed the hand of the commander of the faithful, and his titles were proclaimed by the voice of heralds and the applause of the Muslims. At a second visit to Baghdad, the Seljukian prince again rescued the caliph from his enemies and devoutly, on foot, led the bridle of his mule from the prison to the palace. Their alliance was cemented by the marriage of Toghrul's sister with the successor of the prophet. Without reluctance, he had introduced a Turkish virgin into his harem. But Qayyim proudly refused his daughter to the sultan, disdained to mingle the blood of the Hashemites with the blood of a Scythian shepherd, and protracted the negotiation many months, till the gradual diminution of his revenue admonished him that he was still in the hands of a master. The royal nuptials were followed by the death of Toghrul himself. As he left no children, his nephew, Alp Arslan, succeeded to the title and prerogatives of sultan. And his name, after that of the caliph, was pronounced in the public prayers of the Muslims. Yet in this revolution, the Abbasides acquired a larger measure of liberty and power. On the throne of Asia, the Turkish monarchs were less jealous of the domestic administration of Baghdad, and the commanders of the faithful were relieved from the ignominious vexations to which they had been exposed by the presence and poverty of the Persian dynasty. Since the fall of the caliphs, the discord and degeneracy of the Saracens respected the Asiatic provinces of Rome, which by the victories of Nicephorus, Zimisces, and Basil had been extended as far as Antioch and the eastern boundaries of Armenia. 25 years after the death of Basil, his successors were suddenly assaulted by an unknown race of barbarians who united the Scythian valor with the fanaticism of new proselytes and the art and riches of a powerful monarchy. The myriads of Turkish horse overspread a frontier of 600 miles from Tauris to Arzeorum, and the blood of 130,000 Christians was a grateful sacrifice to the Arabian prophet. Yet the arms of Togrul did not make any deep or lasting impression on the Greek Empire. The torrent rolled away from the open country. The Sultan retired, without glory or success, from the siege of an Armenian city. The obscure hostilities were continued or suspended with a vicissitude of events, and the bravery of the Macedonian legions renewed the fame of the conqueror of Asia. The name of Alp Arslan, the valiant lion, is expressive of the popular idea of the perfection of man, and the successor of Togrul displayed the fierceness and generosity of the royal animal. He passed the Euphrates at the head of the Turkish cavalry and entered Caesarea, the metropolis of Cappadocia, to which he had been attracted by the fame and wealth of the Temple of St. Basil. The solid structure resisted the destroyer, but he carried away the doors of the shrine encrusted with golden pearls, and profaned the relics of the tutelar saint, whose mortal frailties were now covered by the venerable rust of antiquity. The final conquest of Armenia and Georgia was achieved by Alp Arslan. In Armenia, the title of a kingdom and the spirit of a nation were annihilated. The artificial fortifications were yielded by the mercenaries of Constantinople, by strangers without faith, veterans without pay or arms, and recruits without experience or discipline. The loss of this important frontier was the news of a day, and the Catholics were neither surprised nor displeased that a people so deeply infected with the Nestorian and Eutychian errors had been delivered by Christ and his mother into the hands of the infidels. The woods and valleys of Mount Caucasus were more strenuously defended by the native Georgians, or Iberians, but the Turkish Sultan and his son Malek were indefatigable in this holy war. Their captives were compelled to promise a spiritual as well as temporal obedience, and instead of their collars and bracelets, an iron horseshoe, a badge of ignominy, was imposed on the infidels who still adhered to the worship of their fathers. The change, however, was not sincere or universal, and through ages of servitude, the Georgians have maintained the succession of their princes and bishops. But a race of men whom nature has cast in her most perfect mould is degraded by poverty, ignorance, and vice. Their profession, and still more their practice of Christianity, is an empty name, and if they have emerged from heresy, it is only because they are too illiterate to remember a metaphysical creed. The false or genuine magnanimity of Mahmud the Ghaznavidi was not imitated by Alp Arslan, and he attacked without scruple the Greek empress Eudokia and her children. His alarming progress compelled her to give herself and her scepter to the hand of a soldier, and Romanus Diogenes was invested with the imperial purple. His patriotism, and perhaps his pride, urged him from Constantinople within 2 months after his accession, and the next campaign he most scandalously took the field during the holy festival of Easter. In the palace, Diogenes was no more than the husband of Eudokia. In the camp, he was the emperor of the Romans, and he sustained that character with feeble resources and invincible courage. By his spirit and success, the soldiers were taught to act, the subjects to hope, and the enemies to fear. The Turks had penetrated into the heart of Phrygia, but the Sultan himself had resigned to his emirs the prosecution of the war, and their numerous detachments were scattered over Asia in the security of conquest. Laden with spoil and careless of discipline, they were separately surprised and defeated by the Greeks. The activity of the emperor seemed to multiply his presence, and while they heard of his expedition to Antioch, the enemy felt his sword on the hills of Trebizond. In 3 laborious campaigns, the Turks were driven beyond the Euphrates. In the 4th and last, Romanus undertook the deliverance of Armenia. The desolation of the land obliged him to transport a supply of 2 months' provisions, and he marched forwards to the siege of Malazkerd, an important fortress in the midway between the modern cities of Erzurum and Van. His army amounted, at the least, to 100,000 men. The troops of Constantinople were reinforced by the disorderly multitudes of Phrygia and Cappadocia. But the real strength was composed of the subjects and allies of Europe, the legions of Macedonia, and the squadrons of Bulgaria. The Uzi, a Moldavian horde, who were themselves of the Turkish race, and above all the mercenary and adventurous bands of French and Normans. Their lances were commanded by the valiant Ursel of Balliol, the kinsman or father of the Scottish kings, and were allowed to excel in the exercise of arms, or, according to the Greek style, in the practice of the Pyrrhic dance. On the report of this bold invasion, which threatened his hereditary dominions, Alp Arslan flew to the scene of action at the head of 40,000 horse. His rapid and skillful evolutions distressed and dismayed the superior numbers of the Greeks, and in the defeat of Basilacius, one of their principal generals, he displayed the first example of his valor and clemency. The imprudence of the emperor had separated his forces after the reduction of Malazkerd. It was in vain that he attempted to recall the mercenary Franks. They refused to obey his summons. He disdained to await their return. The desertion of the Uzi filled his mind with anxiety and suspicion. And against the most salutary advice, he rushed forwards to speedy and decisive action. Had he listened to the fair proposals of the Sultan, Romanus might have secured a retreat, perhaps a peace. But in these overtures he supposed the fear or weakness of the enemy, and his answer was conceived in the tone of insult and defiance. If the barbarian wishes for peace, let him evacuate the ground which he occupies for the encampment of the Romans, and surrender his city and palace of Rei as a pledge of his sincerity. Alp Arslan smiled at the vanity of the demand, but he wept the death of so many faithful Muslims, and after a devout prayer proclaimed a free permission to all who were desirous of retiring from the field. With his own hands he tied up his horse's tail, exchanged his bow and arrows for a mace and scimitar, clothed himself in a white garment, perfumed his body with musk, and declared that if he were vanquished, that spot should be the place of his burial. The Sultan himself had affected to cast away his missile weapons, but his hopes of victory were placed in the arrows of the Turkish cavalry, whose squadrons were loosely distributed in the form of a crescent. Instead of the successive lines and reserves of the Grecian tactics, Romulus led his army in a single and solid phalanx, and pressed with vigor and impatience the artful and yielding resistance of the barbarians. In this desultory and fruitless combat he spent the greater part of a summer's day, until prudence and fatigue compelled him to return to his camp. But a retreat is always perilous in the face of an active foe, and no sooner had the standard been turned to the rear than the phalanx was broken by the base cowardice, or the baser jealousy, of Andronicus, a rival prince who disgraced his birth and the purple of the Caesars. The Turkish squadrons poured a cloud of arrows on this moment of confusion and lassitude, and the horns of their formidable crescent were closed in the rear of the Greeks. In the destruction of the army and pillage of the camp, it would be needless to mention the number of the slain or captives. The Byzantine writers deplore the loss of an inestimable pearl. They forgot to mention that in this fatal day, the Asiatic provinces of Rome were irretrievably sacrificed. As long as a hope survived, Romanus attempted to rally and save the relics of his army. When the center, the imperial station, was left naked on all sides and encompassed by the victorious Turks, he still, with desperate courage, maintained the fight till the close of day, at the head of the brave and faithful subjects who adhered to his standard. They fell around him. His horse was slain. The emperor was wounded. Yet he stood alone and intrepid till he was oppressed and bound by the strength of multitudes. The glory of this illustrious prize was disputed by a slave and a soldier. A slave who had seen him on the throne of Constantinople, and a soldier whose extreme deformity had been excused on the promise of some signal service. Despoiled of his arms, his jewels, and his purple, Romanus spent a dreary and perilous night on the field of battle amidst a disorderly crowd of the meaner barbarians. In the morning, the royal captive was presented to Alp Arslan, who doubted of his fortune, till the identity of the person was ascertained by the report of his ambassadors, and by the more pathetic evidence of Basilacius, who embraced with tears the feet of his unhappy sovereign. The successor of Constantine, in a plebeian habit, was led into the Turkish divan, and commanded to kiss the ground before the Lord of Asia. He reluctantly obeyed, and Alp Arslan, starting from his throne, is said to have planted his feet on the neck of the Roman emperor. But the fact is doubtful. And if in this moment of insolence the Sultan complied with the national custom, the rest of his conduct has extorted the praise of his bigoted foes and may afford a lesson to the most civilized ages. He instantly raised the royal captive from the ground, and thrice, clasping his hand with tender sympathy, assured him that his life and dignity should be inviolate in the hands of a prince who had learned to respect the majesty of his equals and the vicissitudes of fortune. From the divan, Romanus was conducted to an adjacent tent, where he was served with pomp and reverence by the officers of the Sultan, who, twice each day, seated him in the place of honor at his own table. In a free and familiar conversation of 8 days, not a word, not a look of insult escaped from the conqueror. But he severely censured the unworthy subjects who had deserted their valiant prince in the hour of danger, and gently admonished his antagonist of some errors which he had committed in the management of the war. In the preliminaries of negotiation, Alp Arslan asked him what treatment he expected to receive, and the calm indifference of the emperor displays the freedom of his mind. "If you are cruel," said he, "you will take my life. If you listen to pride, you will drag me at your chariot wheels. If you consult your interest, you will accept a ransom and restore me to my country." "And what," continued the Sultan, "would have been your own behavior had fortune smiled on your arms?" The reply of the Greek betrays a sentiment which prudence and even gratitude should have taught him to suppress. "Had I vanquished," he fiercely said, "I would have inflicted on thy body many a stripe." The Turkish conqueror smiled at the insolence of his captive, observed that the Christian law inculcated the love of enemies and forgiveness of injuries, and nobly declared that he would not imitate an example which he condemned. After mature deliberation, Alp Arslan dictated the terms of liberty and peace. A ransom of 1,000,000, an annual tribute of 360,000 pieces of gold, the marriage of the royal children, and the deliverance of all the Muslims who were in the power of the Greeks. Romanus, with a sigh, subscribed this treaty, so disgraceful to the majesty of the empire. He was immediately invested with a Turkish robe of honor. His nobles and patricians were restored to their sovereign, and the Sultan, after a courteous embrace, dismissed him with rich presents and a military guard. No sooner did he reach the confines of the empire than he was informed that the palace and provinces had disclaimed their allegiance to a captive. A sum of 200,000 pieces was painfully collected, and the fallen monarch transmitted this part of his ransom with a sad confession of his impotence and disgrace. The generosity, or perhaps the ambition, of the Sultan prepared to espouse the cause of his ally, but his designs were prevented by the defeat imprisonment, and death of Romanus Diogenes. In the Treaty of Peace it does not appear that Alp Arslan extorted any province or city from the captive emperor, and his revenge was satisfied with the trophies of his victory and the spoils of Anatolia, from Antioch to the Black Sea. The fairest part of Asia was subject to his laws. 1,200 princes, or the sons of princes, stood before his throne, and 200,000 soldiers marched under his banners. The Sultan disdained to pursue the fugitive Greeks, but he meditated the more glorious conquest of Turkestan, the original seat of the House of Seljuk. He moved from Baghdad to the banks of the Oxus. A bridge was thrown over the river, and 20 days were consumed in the passage of his troops. But the progress of the great king was retarded by the governor of Berzim, and Joseph the Karizmian presumed to defend his fortress against the powers of the East. When he was produced, a captive in the royal tent, the Sultan, instead of praising his valor, severely reproached his obstinate folly, and the insolent replies of the rebel provoked a sentence that he should be fastened to 4 stakes and left to expire in that painful situation. At this command, the desperate Karizmian, drawing a dagger, rushed headlong towards the throne. The guards raised their battle axes. Their zeal was checked by Alp Arslan, the most skillful archer of the age. He drew his bow, but his foot slipped. The arrow glanced aside, and he received in his breast the dagger of Joseph, who was instantly cut in pieces. The wound was mortal, and the Turkish prince bequeathed a dying admonition to the pride of kings. "In my youth," said Alp Arslan, "I was advised by a sage to humble myself before God, to distrust my own strength, and never to despise the most contemptible foe. I have neglected these lessons, and my neglect has been deservedly punished. Yesterday, as from an eminence, I beheld the numbers, the discipline, and the spirit of my armies. The earth seemed to tremble under my feet. And I said in my heart, 'Surely thou art the king of the world, the greatest and most invincible of warriors. These armies are no longer mine, and in the confidence of my personal strength, I now fall by the hand of an assassin.'" Alp Arslan possessed the virtues of a Turk and a Muslim. His voice and stature commanded the reverence of mankind. His face was shaded with long whiskers, and his ample turban was fashioned in the shape of a crown. The remains of the Sultan were deposited in the tomb of the Seljukian dynasty, and the passenger might read and meditate this useful inscription: "O ye who have seen the glory of Alp Arslan exalted to the heavens, repair to Maru, and you will behold it buried in the dust." The annihilation of the inscription and the tomb itself more forcibly proclaims the instability of human greatness. During the life of Alp Arslan, his eldest son had been acknowledged as the future Sultan of the Turks. On his father's death, the inheritance was disputed by an uncle, a cousin, and a brother. They drew their scimitars and assembled their followers. And the triple victory of Malik Shah established his own reputation and the right of primogeniture. In every age, and more especially in Asia, the thirst of power has inspired the same passions and occasioned the same disorders. But from the long series of civil war, it would not be easy to extract a sentiment more pure and magnanimous than is contained in the saying of the Turkish prince. On the eve of the battle, he performed his devotions at Tus, before the tomb of the Imam Riza. As the Sultan rose from the ground, he asked his vizier Nizam, who had knelt beside him, what had been the object of his secret petition. "That your arms may be crowned with victory," was the prudent and most probably the sincere answer of the minister. "For my part," replied the generous Malek, I implored the Lord of hosts that he would take from me my life and crown, if my brother be more worthy than myself to reign over the Muslims. The favorable judgment of heaven was ratified by the caliph, and for the first time the sacred title of Commander of the Faithful was communicated to a barbarian. But this barbarian, by his personal merit and the extent of his empire, was the greatest prince of his age. After the settlement of Persia and Syria, he marched at the head of innumerable armies to achieve the conquest of Turkestan, which had been undertaken by his father. In his passage of the Oxus, the boatmen who had been employed in transporting some troops complained that their payment was assigned on the revenues of Antioch. The Sultan frowned at this preposterous choice, but he smiled at the artful flattery of his vizier. It was not to postpone their reward that I selected those remote places, but to leave a memorial to posterity that under your reign, Antioch and the Oxus was subject to the same sovereign. But this description of his limits was unjust and parsimonious. Beyond the Oxus he reduced to his obedience the cities of Bukhara, Karizmi, and Samarkand, and crushed each rebellious slave or independent savage who dared to resist. Malek passed the Sihon, or Jaxartes, the last boundary of Persian civilization. The hordes of Turkestan yielded to his supremacy. His name was inserted on the coins and in the prayers of Kashgar, a Tatar kingdom on the extreme borders of China. From the Chinese frontier he stretched his immediate jurisdiction, or feudatory sway, to the west and south, as far as the mountains of Georgia, the neighborhood of Constantinople, the holy city of Jerusalem, and the spicy groves of Arabia Felix. Instead of resigning himself to the luxury of his harem, the shepherd king, both in peace and war, was in action and in the field. By the perpetual motion of the royal camp, each province was successively blessed with his presence, and he is said to have perambulated 12 times the wide extent of his dominions, which surpassed the Asiatic reign of Cyrus and the caliphs. Of these expeditions, the most pious and splendid was the pilgrimage of Mecca. The freedom and safety of the caravans were protected by his arms. The citizens and pilgrims were enriched by the profusion of his alms, and the desert was cheered by the places of relief and refreshment which he instituted for the use of his brethren. Hunting was the pleasure and even the passion of the Sultan, and his train consisted of 47,000 horses. But after the massacre of a Turkish chase, for each piece of game, he bestowed a piece of gold on the poor, a slight atonement at the expense of the people for the cost and mischief of the amusement of kings. In the peaceful prosperity of his reign, the cities of Asia were adorned with palaces and hospitals, with mosques and colleges. Few departed from his divan without reward, and none without justice. The language and literature of Persia revived under the house of Seljuk, and if Malek emulated the liberality of a Turk less potent than himself, his palace might resound with the songs of 100 poets. The Sultan bestowed a more serious and learned care on the reformation of the calendar, which was effected by a general assembly of the astronomers of the East. By law of the Prophet, the Muslims are confined to the irregular course of the lunar months. In Persia, since the age of Zoroaster, the revolution of the sun has been known and celebrated as an annual festival. But after the fall of the Magian Empire, the intercalation had been neglected. The fractions of minutes and hours were multiplied into days, and the date of the springs was removed from the sign of Aries to that of Pisces. The reign of Malek was illustrated by the Galilean era, and all errors, either past or future, were corrected by computation of time, which surpasses the Julian and approaches the accuracy of the Gregorian style. In a period when Europe was plunged in the deepest barbarism, The light and splendour of Asia might be ascribed to the docility rather than the knowledge of the Turkish conquerors. An ample share of their wisdom and virtue is due to a Persian vizier who ruled the empire under the reigns of Alp Arslan and his son. Nizam, one of the most illustrious ministers of the East, was honored by the caliph as an oracle of religion and science. He was trusted by the sultan as the faithful vice-regent of his power and justice. After the administration of 30 years, the fame of the vizier, his wealth, and even his services were transformed into crimes. He was overthrown by the insidious arts of a woman and a rival, and his fall was hastened by a rash declaration that his cap and inkhorn, the badges of his office, were connected by the divine decree with the throne and diadem of the sultan. At the age of 93 years, the venerable statesman was dismissed by his master, accused by his enemies, and murdered by a fanatic. The last words of Nizam attested his innocence, and the remainder of Malek's life was short and inglorious. From Isfahan, the scene of this disgraceful transaction, the sultan moved to Baghdad, with the design of transplanting the caliph and of fixing his own residence in the capital of the Muslim world. The feeble successor of Muhammad obtained a respite of 10 days, and before the expiration of the term, the barbarian was summoned by the angel of death. His ambassadors at Constantinople had asked in marriage a Roman princess, but the proposal was decently eluded, and the daughter of Alexius, who might herself have been the victim, expresses her abhorrence of his unnatural conjunction. The daughter of the sultan was bestowed on the caliph Muqtadi, with the imperious condition that, renouncing the society of his wives and concubines, he should forever confine himself to this honorable alliance. The greatness and unity of the Turkish Empire expired in the person of Malek Shah. His vacant throne was disputed by his brother and his 4 sons, and after a series of civil wars, the treaty which reconciled the surviving candidates confirmed a lasting separation in the Persian dynasty, the eldest and principal branch of the House of Seljuk. The 3 younger dynasties were those of Kerman, of Syria, and of Rum. The first of these commanded an extensive, though obscure, dominion on the shores of the Indian Ocean. The second expelled the Arabian princes of Aleppo and Damascus, and the third, our peculiar care, invaded the Roman provinces of Asia Minor. The generous policy of Malek contributed to their elevation. He allowed the princes of his blood, even those whom he had vanquished on the field, to seek new kingdoms worthy of their ambition. Nor was he displeased that they should draw away the more ardent spirits who might have disturbed the tranquillity of his reign. As the supreme head of his family and nation, the great Sultan of Persia commanded the obedience and tribute of his royal brethren. The thrones of Kerman and Nice, of Aleppo and Damascus, the Atabeks and Emirs of Syria and Mesopotamia, erected their standards under the shadow of his scepter, and the hordes of Turkmens overspread the plains of the Western Asia. After the death of Malek, the bands of union and subordination were relaxed and finally dissolved. The indulgence of the House of Seljuk invested their slaves with the inheritance of kingdoms, and in the Oriental style, a crowd of princes arose from the dust of their feet. A prince of the royal line, Kutulmish, the son of Israel, the son of Seljuk, had fallen in a battle against Alp Arslan, and the humane victor had dropped a tear over his grave. His 5 sons, strong in arms, ambitious of power, and eager for revenge, unsheathed their scimitars against the son of Alp Arslan. The 2 armies expected the signal when the caliph, forgetful of the majesty which secluded him from vulgar eyes, interposed his venerable mediation. Instead of shedding the blood of your brethren both in descent and faith, unite your forces in a holy war against the Greeks, the enemies of God and his apostle. They listened to his voice. The Sultan embraced his rebellious kinsmen, and the eldest, the valiant Suleiman, accepted the royal standard, which gave him the free conquest and hereditary command of the provinces of the Roman Empire, from Erzurum to Constantinople and the unknown regions of the west. Accompanied by his four brothers, he passed the Euphrates. The Turkish camp was soon seated in the neighborhood of Kutaye in Phrygia, and his flying cavalry laid waste the country as far as the Hellespont and the Black Sea. Since the decline of the empire, the peninsula of Asia Minor had been exposed to the transient, though destructive, inroads of the Persians and Saracens, but the fruits of a lasting conquest were reserved for the Turkish Sultan, and his arms were introduced by the Greeks, who aspired to reign on the ruins of their country. Since the captivity of Romanus, 6 years the feeble son of Eudokia had trembled under the weight of the imperial crown, till the provinces of the east and west were lost in the same month by a double rebellion. Of either chief, Nicephorus was the common name, but the surnames of Bryennius and Bertoniates distinguished the European and Asiatic candidates. Their reasons, or rather their promises, were weighed in the Divan, and after some hesitation, Suleiman declared himself in favor of Bertoniates, opened a free passage to his troops in their march from Antioch to Nice, and joined the banner of the Crescent to that of the Cross. After his ally had ascended the throne of Constantinople, the Sultan was hospitably entertained in the suburb of Chrysopolis, or Scutari, and a body of 2,000 Turks was transported into Europe, to whose dexterity and courage the new emperor was indebted for the defeat and captivity of his rival, Bryennius. But the conquest of Europe was dearly purchased by the sacrifice of Asia. Constantinople was deprived of the obedience and revenue of the provinces beyond the Bosphorus and Hellespont, and the regular progress of the Turks, who fortified the passes of the rivers and mountains, left not a hope of their retreat or expulsion. Another candidate implored the aid of the Sultan. Melusinus, in his purple robes and red buskins, attended the motions of the Turkish camp, and the desponding cities were tempted by the summons of a Roman prince, who immediately surrendered them into the hands of the barbarians. These acquisitions were confirmed by a treaty of peace with the Emperor Alexius. His fear of Robert compelled him to seek the friendship of Suleiman, and it was not till after the Sultan's death that he extended as far as Nicomedia, about 60 miles from Constantinople, the eastern boundary of the Roman world. Trebizond alone, defended on either side by the sea and mountains, preserved at the extremity of the Black Sea the ancient character of a Greek colony and the future destiny of a Christian empire. Since the first conquests of the caliphs, the establishment of the Turks in Anatolia, or Asia Minor, was the most deplorable loss which the church and empire had sustained. By the propagation of the Muslim faith, Suleiman deserved the name of Ghazi, a holy champion, and his new kingdoms, of the Romans, or of Rum, was added to the tables of Oriental geography. It is described as extending from the Euphrates to Constantinople, from the Black Sea to the confines of Syria, pregnant with mines of silver and iron, of alum and copper, fruitful in corn and wine, and productive of cattle and excellent horses. The wealth of Lydia, the arts of the Greeks, the splendor of the Augustan age, existed only in books and ruins, which were equally obscure in the eyes of the Scythian conquerors. Yet in the present decay, Anatolia still contained some wealthy and populous cities, and under the Byzantine Empire they were far more flourishing in numbers, size, and opulence. By the choice of the Sultan, Nice, the metropolis of Bithynia, was preferred for his palace and fortress. The seat of the Seljukian dynasty of Rum was planted 100 miles from Constantinople, and the divinity of Christ was denied and derided in the same temple in which it had been pronounced by the first general synod of the Catholics. The unity of God and the mission of Muhammad were preached in the mosques. The Arabian learning was taught in the schools. the Qadis, judged according to the law of the Quran. The Turkish manners and language prevailed in the cities, and the Turkmen camps were scattered over the plains and mountains of Anatolia. On the hard conditions of tribute and servitude, the Greek Christians might enjoy the exercise of their religion. But their most holy churches were profaned. Their priests and bishops were insulted. They were compelled to suffer the triumph of the pagans and the apostasy of their brethren. Many thousand children were marked by the knife of circumcision, and many thousand captives were devoted to the service or the pleasures of their masters. After the loss of Asia, Antioch still maintained her primitive allegiance to Christ and Caesar. But the solitary province was separated from all Roman aid and surrounded on all sides by the Mohammedan powers. The despair of Philaretes, the governor, prepared the sacrifice of his religion and loyalty, had not his guilt been prevented by his son, who hastened to the Nicene palace and offered to deliver this valuable prize into the hands of Suleiman. The ambitious sultan mounted on horseback, and in 12 nights, for he reposed in the day, performed a march of 600 miles. Antioch was oppressed by the speed and secrecy of his enterprise, and the dependent cities as far as Laodicea and the confines of Aleppo obeyed the example of the metropolis. From Laodicea to the Thracian Bosphorus, or arm of St. George, the conquests and reign of Suleiman extended 30 days' journey in length, and in breadth about 10 or 15, between the rocks of Lycia and the Black Sea. The Turkish ignorance of navigation protected for a while the inglorious safety of the emperor. But no sooner had a fleet of 200 ships been constructed by the hands of the captive Greeks than Alexius trembled behind the walls of his capital. His plaintive epistles were dispersed over Europe to excite the compassion of the Latins and to paint the danger, the weakness, and the riches of the city of Constantine. But the most interesting conquest of the Seljukian Turks was that of Jerusalem, which soon became the theater of nations. In their capitulation with Omar, the inhabitants had stipulated the assurance of their religion and property. But the articles were interpreted by a master against whom it was dangerous to dispute. And in the 400 years of the reign of the caliphs, the political climate of Jerusalem was exposed to the vicissitudes of storm and sunshine. By the increase of proselytes and population, the Mohammedans might excuse the usurpation of 3/4 of the city. But a peculiar quarter was reserved for the patriarch with his clergy and people. A tribute of 2 pieces of gold was the price of protection. And the sepulchre of Christ, with the Church of the Resurrection, was still left in the hands of his votaries. Of these votaries, the most numerous and respectable portion were strangers to Jerusalem. The pilgrimages to the Holy Land had been stimulated, rather than suppressed, by the conquest of the Arabs, and the enthusiasm which had always prompted these perilous journeys was nourished by the congenial passions of grief and indignation. A crowd of pilgrims from the east and west continued to visit the Holy Sepulchre and the adjacent sanctuaries, more especially at the festival of Easter, than the Greeks and Latins, the Nestorians and Jacobites, the Copts and Abyssinians, the Armenians and Georgians, maintained the chapels, the clergy, and the poor of their respective communions. The harmony of prayer in so many various tongues, the worship of so many nations in the common temple of their religion, might have afforded a spectacle of edification and peace. But the zeal of the Christian sects was embittered by hatred and revenge, and in the kingdom of a suffering Messiah, who had pardoned his enemies, they aspired to command and persecute their spiritual brethren. The preeminence was asserted by the spirit and numbers of the Franks, and the greatness of Charlemagne protected both the Latin pilgrims and the Catholics of the East. The poverty of Carthage, Alexandria, and Jerusalem was relieved by the alms of that pious emperor, and many monasteries of Palestine were founded or restored by his liberal devotion. Harun al-Rashid, the greatest of the Abbasides, esteemed in his Christian brother a similar supremacy of genius and power. Their friendship was cemented by frequent intercourse of gifts and embassies, and the caliph, without resigning the substantial dominion, presented the emperor with the keys of the Holy Sepulchre and, perhaps, of the city of Jerusalem. In the decline of the Carlovingian monarchy, the Republic of Amalfi promoted the interest of trade and religion in the East. Her vessels transported the Latin pilgrims to the coasts of Egypt and Palestine, and deserved by their useful imports the favor and alliance of the Fatimite caliphs. An annual fair was instituted on Mount Calvary, and the Italian merchants founded the convent and hospital of St. John of Jerusalem, the cradle of the monastic and military order which has since reigned in the Isles of Rhodes and of Malta. Had the Christian pilgrims been content to revere the tomb of a prophet, the disciples of Muhammad, instead of blaming, would have imitated their piety. But these rigid Unitarians were scandalized by a worship which represents the birth, death, and resurrection of a god. The Catholic images were branded with the name of idols, and the Muslims smiled with indignation at the miraculous flame which was kindled on the eve of Easter in the Holy Sepulchre. This pious fraud, first devised in the 9th century, was devoutly cherished by the Latin crusaders and is annually repeated by the clergy of the Greek, Armenian, and Coptic sects, who impose on the credulous spectators for their own benefit and that of their tyrants. In every age, a principle of toleration has been fortified by a sense of interest, and the revenue of the prince and his emir was increased each year by the expense and tribute of so many thousand strangers. The revolution which transferred the scepter from the Abbasides to the Fatimites was a benefit rather than an injury to the Holy Land. A sovereign resident in Egypt was more sensible of the importance of Christian trade, and the emirs of Palestine were less remote from the justice and power of the throne. But the third of these Fatimite caliphs was the famous Hakem, a frantic youth who was delivered by his impiety and despotism from the fear either of God or man, and whose reign was a wild mixture of vice and folly. Regardless of the most ancient customs of Egypt, he imposed on the women an absolute confinement. The restraint excited the clamors of both sexes. Their clamors provoked his fury. A part of old Cairo was delivered to the flames, and the guards and citizens were engaged many days in a bloody conflict. At first the caliph declared himself a zealous Muslim, the founder or benefactor of mosques and colleges. 1,290 copies of the Quran were transcribed at his expense in letters of gold, and his edict extirpated the vineyards of the Upper Egypt. But his vanity was soon flattered by the hope of introducing a new religion. He aspired above the fame of a prophet, and styled himself the visible image of the Most High God, who, after 9 apparitions on earth, was at length manifest in his royal person. At the name of Hakem, the Lord of the living and the dead, every knee was bent in religious adoration. His mysteries were performed on a mountain near Cairo. 16,000 converts had signed his profession of faith, and at the present hour a free and warlike people, the Druses of Mount Libanus, are persuaded of the life and divinity of a madman and tyrant. In his divine character, Hakem hated the Jews and Christians as the servants of his rivals. While some remains of prejudice or prudence still pleaded in favor of the law of Muhammad. Both in Egypt and Palestine, his cruel and wanton persecution made some martyrs and many apostles. The common rights and special privileges of the sectaries were equally disregarded, and a general interdict was laid on the devotion of strangers and natives. The temple of the Christian world, the Church of the Resurrection, was demolished to its foundations. The luminous prodigy of Easter was interrupted, and much profane labor was exhausted to destroy the cave in the rock which properly constitutes the Holy Sepulchre. At the report of this sacrilege, the nations of Europe were astonished and afflicted. But instead of arming in the defense of the Holy Land, they contented themselves with burning or banishing the Jews as the secret advisers of the impious barbarian. Yet the calamities of Jerusalem were in some measure alleviated by the inconstancy or repentance of Hakem himself, and the royal mandate was sealed for the restitution of the churches, when the tyrant was assassinated by the emissaries of his sister. The succeeding caliphs resumed the maxim of religion and policy. A free toleration was again granted. With the pious aid of the Emperor of Constantinople, the Holy Sepulchre arose from its ruins, and after a short abstinence, the pilgrims returned with an increase of appetite to the spiritual feast. In the sea voyage of Palestine, the dangers were frequent, and the opportunities rare. But the conversion of Hungary opened a safe communication between Germany and Greece. The charity of Saint Stephen, the apostle of his kingdom, relieved and conducted his itinerant brethren, and from Belgrade to Antioch they traversed 1,500 miles of a Christian empire. Among the Franks, the zeal of pilgrimage prevailed beyond the example of former times, and the roads were covered with multitudes of either sex and of every rank who professed their contempt of life so soon as they should have kissed the tomb of their Redeemer. Princes and prelates abandoned the care of their dominions, and the numbers of these pious caravans were a prelude to the armies which marched in the ensuing age under the banner of the cross. About 30 years before the First Crusade, the Archbishop of Mentz, with the bishops of Utrecht, Bamberg, and Ratisbonne, undertook this laborious journey from the Rhine to the Jordan, and the multitude of their followers amounted to 7,000 persons. At Constantinople they were hospitably entertained by the emperor, but the ostentation of their wealth provoked the assault of the wild Arabs. They drew their swords with scrupulous reluctance and sustained siege in the village of Capernaum until they were rescued by the venal protection of the Fatimite emir. After visiting the holy places, they embarked for Italy, but only a remnant of 2,000 arrived in safety in their native land. Ingulfus, a secretary of William the Conqueror, was a companion of this pilgrimage. He observes that they sailed from Normandy, 30 stout and well-appointed horsemen, but that they repassed the Alps, 20 miserable palmers, with the staff in their hand and the wallet at their back. After the defeat of the Romans, the tranquility of the Fatimite caliphs was invaded by the Turks. One of the lieutenants of Malek Shah, Atsiz the Kharizmian, marched into Syria at the head of a powerful army, and reduced Damascus by famine and the sword. Homs and the other cities of the province acknowledged the caliph of Baghdad and the sultan of Persia, and the victorious emir advanced without resistance to the banks of the Nile. The Fatimite was preparing to fly into the heart of Africa, but the negroes of his guard and the inhabitants of Cairo made a desperate sally and repulsed the Turk from the confines of Egypt. In his retreat he indulged the license of slaughter and rapine. The judge and notaries of Jerusalem were invited to his camp, and their execution was followed by the massacre of 3,000 citizens. The cruelty or the defeat of Atsiz was soon punished by the Sultan Tukush, the brother of Malek Shah, who, with a higher title and more formidable powers, asserted the dominion of Syria and Palestine. The House of Seljuk reigned about 20 years in Jerusalem, but the hereditary command of the holy city and territory was entrusted or abandoned to the emir Otok, the chief of a tribe of Turkmens, whose children, after their expulsion from Palestine, formed 2 dynasties on the borders of Armenia and Assyria. The Oriental Christians and the Latin pilgrims deplored a revolution which, instead of the regular government and old alliance of the caliphs, imposed on their necks the iron yoke of the strangers of the north. In his court and camp, the great sultan had adopted in some degree the arts and manners of Persia, but the body of the Turkish nation, and more especially the pastoral tribes, still breathed the fierceness of the desert. From Nice to Jerusalem, the western countries of Asia were a scene of foreign and domestic hostility, and the shepherds of Palestine, who held a precarious sway on a doubtful frontier, had neither leisure nor capacity to await the slow profits of commercial and religious freedom. The pilgrims who, through innumerable perils, had reached the gates of Jerusalem were the victims of private rapine or public oppression, and often sunk under the pressure of famine and disease before they were permitted to salute the Holy Sepulchre. A spirit of native barbarism or recent zeal prompted the Turkmans to insult the clergy of every sect. The patriarch was dragged by the hair along the pavement and cast into a dungeon to extort a ransom from the sympathy of his flock, and the divine worship in the Church of the Resurrection was often disturbed by the savage rudeness of its masters. The pathetic tale excited the millions of the West to march under the standard of the cross to the relief of the Holy Land. And yet how trifling is the sum of these accumulated evils if compared with the single act of the sacrilege of Hakem, which had been so patiently endured by the Latin Christians. A slighter provocation inflamed the more irascible temper of their descendants. A new spirit had arisen of religious chivalry and papal dominion. A nerve was touched of exquisite feeling, and the sensation vibrated to the heart of Europe. Chapter 58. Origin and numbers of the First Crusade. Characters of the Latin princes. Their march to Constantinople. Policy of the Greek Emperor Alexius. Conquest of Nice, Antioch, and Jerusalem by the Franks. Deliverance of the Holy Sepulchre. Godfrey of Bouillon, first king of Jerusalem. Institutions of the French or Latin Kingdom. About 20 years after the conquest of Jerusalem by the Turks, the Holy Sepulchre was visited by a hermit of the name of Peter, a native of Amiens in the province of Picardy, in France. His resentment and sympathy were excited by his own injuries and the oppression of the Christian name. He mingled his tears with those of the patriarch and earnestly inquired if no hopes of relief could be entertained from the Greek emperors of the East. The patriarch exposed the vices and weakness of the successors of Constantine. "I will rouse," exclaimed the hermit, "the martial nations of Europe in your cause." And Europe was obedient to the call of the hermit. The astonished patriarch dismissed him with epistles of credit and complaint, and no sooner did he land at Bari than Peter hastened to kiss the feet of the Roman pontiff. His stature was small, his appearance contemptible, but his eye was keen and lively, and he possessed that vehemence of speech which seldom fails to impart the persuasion of the soul. He was born of a gentleman's family, for we must now adopt a modern idiom, and his military service was under the neighboring counts of Boulogne, the heroes of the First Crusade. But he soon relinquished the sword and the world, and if it be true that his wife, however noble, was aged and ugly, he might withdraw with the less reluctance from her bed to a convent, and at length to a hermitage. In this austere solitude his body was emaciated, his fancy was inflamed. Whatever he wished, he believed. Whatever he believed, he saw in dreams and revelations. From Jerusalem the pilgrim returned an accomplished fanatic, but as he excelled in the popular madness of the times, Pope Urban II received him as a prophet, applauded his glorious design, promised to support it in a general council, and encouraged him to proclaim the deliverance of the Holy Land. Invigorated by the approbation of the pontiff, his zealous missionary traversed, with speed and success, the provinces of Italy and France. His diet was abstemious, his prayers long and fervent, and the alms which he received with one hand he distributed with the other. His head was bare, his feet naked, his meagre body was wrapped in a coarse garment. He bore and displayed a weighty crucifix, and the ass on which he rode was sanctified in the public eye by the service of the man of God. He preached to innumerable crowds in the churches, the streets, and the highways. The hermit entered with equal confidence the palace and the cottage, and the people, for all was people, was impetuously moved by his call to repentance and arms. When he painted the sufferings of the natives and pilgrims of Palestine, every heart was melted to compassion, every breast glowed with indignation. When he challenged the warriors of the age to defend their brethren and rescue their Savior, his ignorance of art and language was compensated by sighs and tears and ejaculations. Then Peter supplied the deficiency of reason by loud and frequent appeals to Christ and his mother, to the saints and angels of paradise with whom he had personally conversed. The most perfect orator of Athens might have envied the success of his eloquence. The rustic enthusiast inspired the passions which he felt, and Christendom expected with impatience the counsels and decrees of the supreme pontiff. The magnanimous spirit of Gregory the Seventh had already embraced the design of arming Europe against Asia. The ardor of his zeal and ambition still breathes in his epistles. From either side of the Alps, 50,000 Catholics had enlisted under the banner of St. Peter, and his successor reveals his intention of marching at their head against the impious sectaries of Mohammed. But the glory or reproach of executing, though not in person, this holy enterprise was reserved for Urban II, the most faithful of his disciples. He undertook the conquest of the East, whilst a larger portion of Rome was possessed and fortified by his rival Gibert of Ravenna, who contended with Urban for the name and honours of the pontificate. He attempted to unite the powers of the West at a time when the princes were separated from the church and the people from their princes by the excommunication which himself and his predecessors had thundered against the emperor and the king of France. Philip I of France supported with patience the censures which he had provoked by his scandalous life and adulterous marriage. Henry IV of Germany asserted the right of investitures, the prerogative of confirming his bishops by the delivery of the ring and crosier. But the emperor's party was crushed in Italy by the arms of the Normans and the Countess Matilda, and the long quarrel had been recently envenomed by the revolt of his son Conrad and the shame of his wife, who in the synods of Constance and Placentia confessed the manifold prostitutions to which she had been exposed by a husband regardless of her honour and his own. So popular was the cause of Urban, so weighty was his influence, that the council which he summoned at Placentia was composed of 200 bishops of Italy, France, Burgundy, Swabia, and Bavaria. 4,000 of the clergy and 30,000 of the laity attended this important meeting, and as the most spacious cathedral would have been inadequate to the multitude, the session of 7 days was held in a plain adjacent to the city. The ambassadors of the Greek emperor, Alexius Comnenus, were introduced to plead the distress of their sovereign and the danger of Constantinople, which was divided only by a narrow sea from the victorious Turks, the common enemies of the Christian name. In their suppliant address they flattered the pride of the Latin princes, and appealing at once to their policy and religion, exhorted them to repel the barbarians on the confines of Asia rather than to expect them in the heart of Europe. At the sad tale of the misery and perils of their eastern brethren, the assembly burst into tears, the most eager champions declared their readiness to march, and the Greek ambassadors were dismissed with the assurance of a speedy and powerful succor. The relief of Constantinople was included in the larger and most distant project of the deliverance of Jerusalem, but the prudent Urban adjourned the final decision to a second synod, which he proposed to celebrate in some city of France in the autumn of the same year. The short delay would propagate the flame of enthusiasm, and his firmest hope was in a nation of soldiers still proud of the preeminence of their name and ambitious to emulate their hero Charlemagne, who, in the popular romance of Toupin, had achieved the conquest of the Holy Land. A latent motive of affection or vanity might influence the choice of Urban. He was himself a native of France, a monk of Cluny, and the first of his countrymen who ascended the throne of St. Peter. The Pope had illustrated his family and province. Nor is there, perhaps, a more exquisite gratification than to revisit in a conspicuous dignity the humble and laborious scenes of our youth. It may occasion some surprise that the Roman pontiff should erect, in the heart of France, the tribunal from whence he hurried his anathemas against the king, but our surprise will vanish so soon as we form a just estimate of a king of France of the 11th century. Philip I was the great-grandson of Hugh Capet, the founder of the present race, who, in the decline of Charlemagne's posterity, added the regal title to his patrimonial estates of Paris and Orléans. In this narrow compass, he was possessed of wealth and jurisdiction. But in the rest of France, Hugh and his first descendants were no more than the feudal lords of about 60 dukes and counts of independent and hereditary power, who disdained the control of laws and legal assemblies, and whose disregard of their sovereign was revenged by the disobedience of their inferior vassals. At Clermont, in the territories of the Count of Auvergne, the Pope might brave with impunity the resentment of Philip, and the council which he convened in that city was not less numerous or respectable than the Synod of Placentia. Besides his court and council of Roman cardinals, he was supported by 13 archbishops and 225 bishops. The number of mitred prelates was computed at 400, and the fathers of the church were blessed by the saints and enlightened by the doctors of the age. From the adjacent kingdoms, a martial train of lords and knights of power and renown attended the council, in high expectation of its resolves. And such was the ardor of zeal and curiosity that the city was filled, and many thousands in the month of November erected their tents or huts in the open field. A session of 8 days produced some useful or edifying canons for the reformation of manners. A severe censure was pronounced against the license of private war. The truce of God was confirmed, a suspension of hostilities during 4 days of the week. Women and priests were placed under the safeguard of the church, and a protection of 3 years was extended to husbandmen and merchants, the defenseless victims of military rapine. But a law, however venerable be the sanction, cannot suddenly transform the temper of the times, and the benevolent efforts of Urban deserve the less praise since he labored to appease some domestic quarrels that he might spread the flames of war from the Atlantic to the Euphrates. From the Synod of Placentia, the rumor of his great design had gone forth among the nations. The clergy, on their return, had preached in every diocese the merit and glory of the deliverance of the Holy Land. And when the Pope ascended a lofty scaffold in the marketplace of Clermont, his eloquence was addressed to a well-prepared and impatient audience. His topics were obvious. His exhortation was vehement. His success inevitable. The orator was interrupted by the shout of thousands who, with one voice and in their rustic idiom, exclaimed aloud, "God wills it. God wills it." "It is indeed the will of God," replied the Pope, "and let this memorable word, the inspiration surely of the Holy Spirit, be forever adopted as your cry of battle, to animate the devotion and courage of the champions of Christ."